Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Vital Health Community call for the month of November 2018. I am thrilled to have you here and to be able to present to you blood pressure. We're inundated by an epidemic of hypertension and people on hypertensive medication. And my hope, my goal, is for everyone to be able to solve their hypertension problems naturally. Before we begin, I want to make sure that you're aware that this presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, especially not medical advice. And if you're on medication for hypertension, for blood pressure, then I want to make sure that you consult with your doctor before you make any changes to your medication. I also want to make sure that you consult with your doctor before putting into practice any of the methodologies and approaches that I talk about here, because it could shift your blood pressure, and in some cases rather quickly. I have worked with people who came and started on some stuff, and like 5 days later, 6 days later, I'm dizzy, I'm lightheaded, and I said, take your blood pressure, and it's gone way low. And then they worked with their doctor to decrease the dose. You do have to decrease doses carefully and slowly, and you do it under the care of a doctor. So this is not medical advice, and I'm just sharing with you what I know from my years of experience, from my research, and with working with a lot of people with blood pressure issues. And if you don't have blood pressure issues, this is still a good call for you to be on, because you want to learn how to protect yourself, protect your cardiovascular system, and prevent those things from happening. And if you're someone at the other end of the spectrum where your blood pressure is too low, we'll talk about that as well. What are the types of hypertension? We see somebody having their blood pressure taken with a cuff, a manual cuff that's done in the doctor's office. And we have two different types. One is primary, or called essential hypertension. And with that, it's what in medicine we call idiopathic. It doesn't mean you're an idiot. It's idiopathic means we don't know what the cause is. Like, there doesn't seem to be any underlying pathology that's contributing to this. Next, we have secondary hypertension, and that's where there is some kind of underlying cause. It often appears suddenly, and usually the pressures are even higher than in primary hypertension. The essential, just kind of gradually the blood pressure builds up. There doesn't seem to be an abrupt start or stop to it, and it gradually gets higher. But in terms of essential and any kind of hypertension, some of the causes are kidney problems, adrenal problems, thyroid problems, congenital blood vessel defects, like, you know, if there's problems with the heart valve or something in the vessels, birth control pills, and a lot of people are on birth control pills, cold remedies, decongestants, and other medications like over-the-counter pain relievers, and some of the prescription drugs. So what I recommend is, before you take any drugs, that you, number one, look for an alternative solution unless it's a life-threatening, but also look for the side effects, and you'll see that some of them may cause hypertension. And if you're already prone to hypertension, already have hypertension, or have a family history of it, you want to be careful and talk to the prescribing physician about what are some alternatives that aren't going to affect my blood pressure. Clearly, if you've just been bitten by a snake, the antivenom that is prescribed to you to save your life makes your blood pressure go up. It's a side effect you're willing to take. Right? But the other thing is to, you know, if you're taking like an over-the-counter pain medication, what can you do to look for alternatives so that you don't take the stuff that's going to raise your blood pressure? The other thing is street drugs, right? Cocaine and amphetamines and things like that can also raise blood pressure. And the other thing that can raise blood pressure is sleep apnea. So if you have obstructive sleep apnea, that can cause your blood pressure to go up. So what are some of the risk factors for hypertension? Well, age is certainly one of them. We find that for the population under 65, mostly men have hypertension, women don't, but over 65, women start to develop more hypertension. Also, race. The African heritage tends to be more prone to hypertension than Caucasian and other historical backgrounds. Family history. Do you have a family history of it? Do you have genes that would be related to the family history? And we'll talk about the genetic risk factors for it as well. So if you're struggling with your blood pressure and you're not able to get it down as well as you like, you want to look at what are some of the underlying causes, and maybe you have to be doing a little bit more. Certainly being overweight or obese will contribute to blood pressure problems, and not being physically active. Stress is one of the biggest ones. Stress is one of the huge ones because it causes an elevation of cortisol. And cortisol by design raises your blood pressure because they're trying to get away from hungry tigers, and you need an increase in blood pressure and blood flow to your extremities to be able to do that. Tobacco, you know, some of those things like smoking, we know that it causes damage to the blood vessels, which can cause plaque buildups. And whenever there's an obstruction in a blood vessel, the blood pressure is going to go up, right? Because the heart is pumping and it's hitting an obstacle. It's pumping and it's hitting an obstacle. So the blood pressure naturally raises. And any kind of damage to the cardiovascular, the blood vessels, will be causing a problem with it. Some people are sensitive to salt. Not everybody is. And that seems to be genetic. And there's some risk factors related to genes we'll talk about with that. Not enough potassium, which is so common in our world because so many people are loading up with sodium. All the fast foods are loaded and loaded and loaded with salt, and that throws off the sodium-potassium balance. So too little potassium, drinking too much alcohol, and for some, too much alcohol is more than zero drinks a day. The occasional glass of wine when you're at somebody's wedding and you're celebrating is different from chronic alcohol use. And some people think over-alcohol use is more than two alcoholic beverages a day. I think that overusing alcohol is more than two beverages a month because I think there's so much damage that's caused and damage to the cardiovascular system, and especially if there's some detox SNPs in the genes. And we talked about stress already, and it's huge, 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 huge. I've had people have their blood pressure drop by as much as 20 points just by sitting with them, taking their blood pressure, doing some heart math, and then testing it again. Not everybody has that result. And part of it is some people are so wound that they have to practice and practice and practice the heart math to actually get into that parasympathetic state. Diabetes is, it's interesting because when a person has diabetes, they're more prone to hypertension because of the damage that the high blood sugar is making to the vessels and the thickening and the stiffening and the glycosylation of the blood cells. But hypertension is a risk factor for diabetes. So when we have hypertension, it can cause more diabetic symptoms to occur. So that goes both ways with that. Here's some of the genetics that predispose people to having hypertension. ACE, it's related to angiotensin, which is a hormone that's actually produced in the kidneys that regulates the blood pressure, the blood volume. Nitric oxide 1, 2, and 3. Nitric oxide synthase is what that stands for. And that's the synthesis of a chemical called nitric oxide, which helps to calm and dilate the vessels. And when there's SNPs in this area, we don't get that calming effect on the vessels and they get constricted. So two of the main underlying, if you look at the chemistry and physiology of blood pressure problems, is that the blood vessels are either too constricted, and that happens with cortisol release, when the blood vessels are constricted in every place except for the extremities, and there's a lot more pressure that's needed to pump that stuff out. And it happens in cases where there's some pressure in there and where there's not the chemicals to do this calming. Omega-3 imbalances, for example, can contribute to blood pressure because they have a vasodilation effect. They tend to reverse some constriction, which is why they're so good for heart and cardiovascular type of things. So the nitric oxide synthase and nitric oxide, one of the ways around this is to actually eat more foods that generate nitric oxide, like arugula and spinach and beet greens and things like that, which are really high in arginine, which will help to make more nitric oxide. Then there's these others. I don't, you know, want to go into the details of every single one of these, but ADD1, AGT, TH, and CYP17A1. And if you do any gene testing and you download your raw data, you may be able to look at these. I don't see a lot of reports showing these last four in terms of the genetic reports that you can run after you get your genes tested, but the ACE and the NOS are definitely reported. And I know people who came to our recent Shine were like, oh, I have all these blood pressure SNPs. So what are some of the complications of hypertension? Well, a heart attack or stroke. You know, when you've got constriction in the blood vessels or a blockage in the blood vessels and the pressure is high, it can block off blood to the brain or to the heart and you get a heart attack or stroke. And a heart attack and a stroke are really the same events. It's an ischemic event, meaning lack of oxygen to either the brain in a stroke or to the heart in heart attack. And the technical name for heart attack is myocardial infarction, MI. So we say heart attack. An aneurysm, right? An aneurysm is an outpouching of a blood vessel, and that can burst. There's an outpouching, and then that burst that causes major bleed. And a friend of ours' husband suddenly dropped dead of an aneurysm that burst, right? I don't know his history. I don't know his health history. I don't know if he had hypertension, but that contributes because it's the pressure. If there is an aneurysm, and there are some congenital aneurysms, a Barry aneurysm in the brain, that people can live a long and healthy life with, as long as they don't get into the state where their blood pressure is high and puts pressure on that little outpouching, and then that bursts and it can kill them. Heart failure, like the actual failure of the heart to be able to pump. And because the blood pressure is high, we're not getting the blood back to the heart in the right way. Weakened and narrowed blood vessels in kidneys. And so hypertension can lead to kidney problems, as can diabetes. Thickened, narrowed, or torn blood vessels in the eyes, right? So one of the ways people who are optometrists, I don't know if Louisa, our resident optometrist, is on today, but she looks in people's eyes and she gets to see a window into the rest of the body. She can see if there's probably blood sugar imbalances based on some of the findings in the back of the retina, and certainly hypertension when you see these thickened, narrow, or even torn blood vessels in the back of the eye. So an optometrist would be the one to detect that. And I think more and more of them need to be educated about talking to the people about that and talking about the nutritional approaches that they can take with that. Metabolic syndrome, right? Metabolic syndrome is insulin resistance plus lipid changes like elevated cholesterol, triglycerides, LDLs, and also high blood pressure. And of course, the blood sugar imbalance is elevated glucose. So a complication could be metabolic syndrome. Trouble with memory and dementia. So it affects the brain in such a way, lack of oxygen to the brain can lead to dementia and, short-term loss of memory, but dementia being more of a long-term thing. So what are some contributing factors? These are all things that can cause, they don't always cause, but they can cause your blood pressure to go up. Hypothyroid. Some people with hypothyroid, I was looking at statistics, about 3% of people with blood pressure problems actually have it as a result of hypothyroidism. But certainly it's a factor, and if you address the hypothyroidism, the blood pressure gets better. This one is huge, adrenal stress. We are under a lot of stress. Everybody's always worried about this and worried about that, and how's this gonna go, and the finances, and if you watch the news, their whole goal is to get you worried and stressed out so that you'll buy from their sponsors whatever they happen to be selling. But that's just their way, right? To get attention, to get the traffic. So what we need to do is learn techniques that will calm and soothe the body and take the adrenals out of stress so the levels of cortisol don't go so high and contribute to the blood pressure. And adrenaline is as another hormone produced by the adrenals. It's a short-term hormone. It comes in, it raises the blood pressure, it gets you out of trouble, and then it goes away. But the cortisol continues the process. And when we stay in more of a low level, not acute stress, but that chronic stress for a long time, the blood pressure does tend to creep up. And if you happen to be a worrier, and in your genetics, there are genes that might predispose you to be more of a worrier or a warrior. A worrier being everything, stresses you out, and a warrior is everything that goes wrong. You're like taking charge and taking care of it. And some people are in between. Insulin resistance and diabetes certainly can contribute to hypertension, as can fatty liver and biliary stasis. So the insulin resistance and diabetes are blood sugar imbalances, which contribute to the blood pressure going up. And then fatty liver and biliary stasis. Biliary is the bile duct, so that's, liver and gallbladder type stuff. Things that can damage the cardiovascular system. So here's where we step in. Here's where we have our natural approaches. And some of it is just the basics that most of you have heard me talk about over and over and over again. And it's basically, you got to get rid of the sugars. I mean, because that contributes to the diabetes and the insulin resistance, it also causes damage to the blood vessel linings. When your blood sugar goes up too high, and it's not even that high, your red blood cells get sugar-coated. They get what's called glycosylated, and they get stiff and they get brittle, and they can damage the delicate endothelial lining of your blood vessels. So sugar and high fructose corn syrup, processed grains, fruit juices, and inflammatory foods. So we have a long list of that. You can look that up in a previous Vital Community talk, but we talked a lot about inflammation in previous ones. So I whole presentation on it. Also in our Eat Your Way Out of Pain, go to eatyourwayoutofpain.com and you'll get a free download, and that has a list of inflammatory foods and a couple of recipes. So it's eatyourwayoutofpain.com. Alcohol. Alcohol damages the vessels. Alcohol damages the liver. It damages blood vessels in your brain. It damages liver cells. And it can contribute to elevated sugar because alcohol gets immediately converted into sugar. Your blood sugars will go up from it. And then trans and heated fats, things like mayonnaise, margarine, hydrogenated fats. I think the world is getting more educated about this, but I remember having arguments with my mother-in-law telling her, don't eat that mayonnaise, don't eat that margarine. I mean, you're better off, I do it instead of butter, it's better. No, but I'm not a fan of butter, but butter is better than margarine because it's hydrogenated. They're taking a perfectly good polyunsaturated oil and adding hydrogen to it to make it saturated. And that artificial saturation is not something the body is meant to be handling, and it causes damage to the blood vessel lining. So that stuff needs to be avoided, as well as caffeine. I know there's mixed feelings. Everybody's into bulletproof coffee, and if you add coconut oil to it, it does this and that. And it may be beneficial in some ways, but everything has a double edge to it. It's a double-edged sword. Yeah, caffeine is not helpful, but the coffee itself may be very have some antioxidants in it, but you have to weigh it against the effects of the tannins and the caffeine and the dehydrating effect of the caffeine, the coffee itself. Low-grade levels, like I would say green tea, has small amounts of caffeine, huge amounts of antioxidants. So I find that balance is fine for many people, except the very sensitive. And again, genes can determine how sensitive you are. Things like matcha tea, they have a little bit of caffeine, but they have a lot of other healing benefits. And coffee, it doesn't seem to have the redeeming qualities. And chocolate has a little bit of caffeine, but not as much. Let's talk about various ways that you can naturally manage hypertension. Magnesium, super, super important. Magnesium is the of muscle contraction. Calcium is the So calcium constricts, magnesium relaxes. And we need both, right? We need the blood vessels to constrict, to push the blood along and to move it to its destination. We need the magnesium to come in and calm it down. So if we have too much calcium compared to magnesium, we're going to have a problem with constricted blood vessels. So how do we get around this? Well, magnesium is abundant in green leafy vegetables. It's abundant in raw cacao, pumpkin seeds. You can also do Epsom salt baths to get it in. And you can also supplement. What I caution is looking at your calcium magnesium ratio. A lot of folks are supplementing like 1500 milligrams a day of calcium for bone. But in reality, bone is not just calcium. There's about 21 different nutrients. We have a Eating for Bone Health program on our site. If you go to our main website and you click on a video shopping and then videos, you'll see an Eating for Bone Health class. And if you haven't already done that, those of you in ERC have that as part of the nutrition part of the Body Freedom Foundations. Those of you in Body Freedom Foundations have that. Those of you in NEPT have that. It's all in what we've given you. But if you're just a Vital member and not a member of those other programs, and you're thinking about, you're struggling with things related to bone health because you're perimenopausal or menopausal, I would highly recommend that program. So supplementation, make sure that the calcium magnesium ratios are close to even, because a lot of people taking 1500 milligrams of calcium because they want to protect their bones are actually not doing themselves justice because it throws off the calcium magnesium ratio. So topical is a good way to get it. You can actually get an oil and put it on your skin. You could put it on the areas that have spasms. It absorbs into the skin and works really well. You can get a liquid form of magnesium that's ionized. I have one. I get it from Ultimate Superfoods. There's other brands that make it, and it's just a liquid and it's ionized, so it doesn't have to go through all the digestive process. It just gets absorbed. And then you can also get a powdered form, magnesium glycinate, citrate, taurate. There's pluses and minuses to each one. Citrate if you have constipation issues, it can help to move the bowels. Glycinate if you have the opposite and you want to calm it down. Taurate if you have trouble with fat absorption, because taurine, that's bound to the magnesium, is an amino acid. That's also a precursor to bile salts, and it's also a precursor to GABA. So make a decision as to which one. Play with them. You know, try different ones. Try the liquid, try the powder, try the topicals, and see what you feel most comfortable with and what you're going to do on a consistent basis. You can also do capsules. I'm just not a fan of capsules in any supplements if we can get a powdered or liquid form, because then we don't have all the encapsulation issues and the additives that are added to create the capsules. So that's one thing. Another thing is reversing your insulin resistance. Die, you know, if you have insulin resistance, we want to manage that. So important pieces that we teach in our sweet spot program for an insulin resistance is stress management. I mean, do some heart math, meditation, yoga, whatever else you feel good with that calms you down. Sit in the sauna. A low glycemic diet, right? Avoiding those high glycemic foods. Of course, avoiding the sugars and the processed fats, but getting a glucose meter and testing yourself, because you may be sensitive to yams or to pineapple or to other fruits, and it's shooting your sugar up and you don't even realize it. And remember that the last thing to shift in diabetes is the fasting glucose. So you may have what the doctor says is a perfectly fine 85 fasting glucose, but you could be a time bomb waiting to happen if you're responding poorly to certain foods. And you can tell that by measuring hemoglobin A1C, by measuring fasting insulin, or by getting your own glucose meter. Chromium is one of the nutrients I put here. Magnesium is also important, but I put chromium in here because I already talked about magnesium, and chromium is a super important nutrient to help get the sugar escorted into the cells. So after a while, we burn out the chromium because you're eating a high starch, high sugar diet, and or you're genetically prone and you're very sensitive. So chromium is super important. I usually recommend around 800 micrograms a day. Micrograms, not milligrams. And fatty acids, especially DHA, because they control, the fatty acids control the strength of the vessels, the constriction and the relaxation, and also inflammation. But DHA in particular has an impact on blood sugar and the transport in the receptors. And then exercise burst training tends to be the best for the insulin resistance. Spacing your meals, timing your meals, all important, and sleep. And we go through all the details of that. We'll be opening up some free content and free series. And actually, we're thinking about, we haven't decided on yet, doing a 5-day blood sugar challenge on our Facebook group. So you might want to keep your eyes open on that. We'll just take you through 5 days. Here's what you eat. Here's what you take, here's what you do for 5 days, and let's see how you feel. And I would want people to measure their blood pressure at the beginning and end, measure your heart rate at the beginning and end, and if you're open to it, get a Keto Mojo and measure your ketones and your blood sugar. So, because you can see dramatic shifts. And then just, of course, observing how you feel. So foods and nutrients that help us with hypertension. Well, potassium-rich foods, because remember when I talked about some of the risk factors or the causes, that low potassium could be one of them. So limes and lemons and avocados and dark green leafy vegetables are all really good sources. Broccoli is a good source of potassium. And then magnesium-rich foods, the dark leafy greens, the raw cacao, the pumpkin seeds, these are your mainstays in terms of diet. But here's the thing, if you've got a messed up digestive tract and it's you don't have enough stomach acid, you may not be absorbing these minerals, and you need a little bit of help with your digestion. And then antioxidant-rich culinary herbs, and I'm differentiating culinary herbs from some of the more therapeutic and nutritional herbs. And these are stuff that you could have in your spice rack, right? Turmeric, ginger, oregano, garlic, basil, thyme, rosemary. And just start sprinkling these into your foods if you're struggling with hypertension or you have a family history of it and you want to prevent it. Hypertension management on the stress reduction side. Well, deep breathing exercises, just focusing on your breath. Just take a second or, you know, 30 seconds to a minute throughout the day to just go. Grounding It's a real great way to take some stress off your body. Go outside daily and walk on the earth without shoes, or get some of those special grounding shoes so that if you don't want to get, you know, dirt or whatever else on your feet. I just love going out in the grass and walking on the grass in my bare feet. HeartMath, right? You've heard me talk about HeartMath a lot. For those of you who are new, HeartMath is that combination of breathing and appreciation. So, and think about something you appreciate. Belly breath, deep belly breath. Meditation and yoga, those take a little time. But you know what? I used to have a hesitation about meditation because it took so much time. Because every meditation class or teacher I spoke to, yeah, you got to do an hour in the morning and an hour at night, or a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour at night. And don't do it too close to bedtime. And don't do it too close to your awakening time. And don't do it too close to meals. And I had two little kids. I just could meditate when I could meditate. Got them down for a nap, I'm going to go meditate, even if it's not the right time of day. And it got frustrating for me. And then I found a device called the Muse. And the Muse is so amazing because it's a little headband you wear, and it measures your time in that calm state that you're going for. And it gives you the percentage of calm, the percentage of active, and the percentage of neutral. And it stores that information and it keeps a running streak. So I'm at, like, I don't know, 455 days straight of meditation. And it keeps me meditating every day, because if I didn't before I did that, I wasn't accountable to anybody. But it's like my little accountability buddy. And I do it every day. And, you know, if I only have 5 minutes, great. This morning I accidentally had set it for 5 minutes. And I just did 5 minutes. And it was like, wow, I was 80% calm in my 5 minutes. So I did another 10 after that, because I'm on the roll of actually wanting to do 20 out of 20 every morning, but I can't always do it. So 5 is fine. 3 is fine. You know, any time you take to just get and calm your mind is going to help with reducing stress. And then, of course, lowering your blood pressure. Yoga, there's different poses. Yoga is very therapeutic. Tapping, you know, EFT, you tap on different points on the meridians and it calms down those repetitive thoughts that keep us going. Journaling every day, you know, end of the day, what are three things you appreciate? Just write it down in your journal. Beginning of the day, what are three things you appreciate and are looking forward to today? And for me, stress reduction is just being out in nature. Just taking a run down to my waterfall and hanging out and watching it for a bit and then running back, going to the beach, going for a hike, going for a walk, going in my backyard and just enjoying the bushes and the plants and some of the herbs that we have growing there. So all of these things can help you. And so if you're struggling with hypertension, it's not one of these. It's not a this for that. This is creating that lifestyle that supports low blood pressure or normal blood pressure. And if you're having trouble with it, then you need to look at all of this, and there may be some deep underlying piece of stress that needs to be resolved. So let's talk about the fun stuff. Let's talk about some of the herbs. A natokinase is an enzyme, and it dissolves clots. So some of the hypertension is there's clots in the bloodstream. It thins the blood and makes it easier to flow. So natokinase, be careful with it. Make sure you're working with somebody or really research the dose. Start really low. If you have any like burning sensations in your stomach when you eat, or, you know, reflux or ulcers or anything, be very careful, because sometimes taking enzymes on an empty stomach, which this needs to be taken in between meals, it can cause irritation. So just go slow with your body. Mistletoe is another one. And it also, you know, it's that thing we do at Christmas time, right? But, and you do be careful, because it can be poisonous. So get an appropriate tincture. Just don't go and start eating mistletoe, because you got to be careful of the dose. So it's not one of those herbs that you just eat as much basil as you want to. No, you got to be careful with that. And then there's something called NRF2. We call it NRF2, nuclear factor erythroid 2. And that's a real important factor in managing hypertension. And some of the things that can help with that, to support that, are resveratrol, And that comes from red wine, but you'd have to drink like, 100 bottles a day to get the amount in there, or they have concentrated resveratrol. Curcumin, which is from turmeric. So adding a lot of turmeric, we buy it by the chunk and we add it to all of our smoothies and salad dressings and sauces and all. And you can get a supplement of it if you're really looking for a higher dose. You can get it liposomal, liquid liposomal. I love to get that from Seeking Health. And I take it when I feel like I need it. Sulforaphane, which is in like broccoli seed extract, or it's actually in all your cruciferous vegetables, but the concentrated amounts that therapeutically may help, you may have to get more concentrated, like broccoli seed extract or broccoli sprout powder. You can get it from real food. You just have to make sure you're eating a lot of it. So it may not have the therapeutic effect if you're already in hypertension and it's uncontrolled, but it definitely will be a good preventative. And these are things I recommend people do on a regular basis. So not resveratrol necessarily, not mistletoe or nattokinase, but certainly curcumin and the broccoli and the carotenoids. So you can get them separately, zeaxanthin and lutein, and that's been shown to help with blood pressure. Now there are some formulations, and some of the formulations are better than others. One of the ones I like a lot is from Restorative Formulations, and they're committed to everything being organic, even their capsules. And I've used a lot of their products. They have one called HTN and HTN Extra, and it helps with the blood pressure, and it has some mistletoe and some of these other herbs in it. I don't remember the exact combination that's in it. The thing with Restorative Formulations is that they will only sell to practitioners or patients who have a practitioner like access code. So if you do want to order anything from Restorative, check out their herbs. You can just find things on Google, but you can't actually order them unless you set up an account as a client there. And so if you go in there, restorativeformulations.com, and when they ask you, you says sign up as a new client. When they ask you for your practitioner number, just give them my number, which is 512-349-9677 and 512-349-9677, and it's in the chat. So you can just put that in and then you can order anything from them. Herbs and foods that support cardiovascular health. So these are fun that you can, some of these you can include as foods and some of them you have to take as supplements. But hawthorn berry, you can eat it as a food. You can order it from Mountain Rose Herbs, the little berries. You can soak them to soften them and blend them into a smoothie or a dessert even. And they're really strong. They really help to support the musculature and the cardiovascular system. And the side effect of that is they also support liver. And they also break down fat. So I was told by one of my herbal medicine teachers in teaching the Chinese medicine part that in China, they actually make a tea out of hawthorn berry. And they use that tea to wipe down the grease off the tables in the restaurants at the end of the day. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And that says, well, it can break down fats. So that's a good one. And it's easy to include. I mean, you can certainly get a tincture or a supplement of it. But I like to go for food first. But not everybody's like that, so wherever you are. The nattokinase actually comes from a food called natto. It's a traditional Japanese food, and it's fermented soybeans. It doesn't taste so good, but there's ways to make it taste good. And my friend Karen Osborne, who many of you know, she's an amazing chef. She created recipes for actually making your own natto, and then how do you make it taste good? And she is committed to eating her little, like I think it's like a 3-ounce serving of it every day, because it has vitamin K2 in it as well. And that helps with bone health. So not only is it good for cardiovascular health, it's good that way. And if you don't actually have a serious problem with it, or you're not working with somebody, you know, be careful about taking the enzyme because it'd be super potent, but eating the natto in a couple ounces a day it's just a food and it has the same therapeutic effect. And she has that. She also has a bunch of other little ebooks for $5 to $7 to $10 that are really excellent. MyFoodFitnessAndFun.com. Lynn mentions asparagus. Yep, absolutely. Garlic, ginger, ginkgo. Ginkgo helps to open blood vessels in the brain And for me, ginkgo gives me a headache. So I think my blood vessels in my brain might also be already open so much that it gives me an extra blood flow to the brain. So I don't do ginkgo real well. Every time I've tried to take it, like when I was studying for exams and things like that, I got a headache. I haven't tried it recently. I should try it again to see if it's still the case. Turmeric, love turmeric, that orange powder there. You can get it as a powder, but you can also get it as the whole root, which is my favorite way to go. Silica. Silica is in horsetail and nettles, really good and really good for cardiovascular health. And basil, just plain old run-of-the-mill basil, also holy basil, which is also called tulsi, which helps really support the adrenals. And all of these things are going to help you in getting your blood pressure under control. And I would really look at exploring these. So if you've tried one and you tried another, it may be the dose, but really try to get these things in on a regular basis. Flaxseed. Good for omega-3s as well. Oregano, it's a good antimicrobial as well. I would alternate oregano. I wouldn't take it every single day just because it could cause your gut flora. If you have bad guys in your gut, if you have dysbiosis in your gut, it can cause them to become resistant. Certainly fiber, and we do that with all of our whole plant foods. Plant sterols, those are in specific foods, the fattier food. Berberine, again, like oregano, I'd alternate that in and out. Berberine is also helpful for blood sugar control, 500 milligrams three times a day. Red yeast rice has been shown to decrease blood pressure and improve cholesterol readings and all that. I'd be a little careful about it just because it does act like a statin and it could cause CoQ10 depletion just like a statin. So that's kind of my last resort in working with folks like this. If the cholesterol is elevated, that could be useful, but I would be careful with it. And spirulina, you can use that abundantly. It's just loaded with good green antioxidants and chlorophyll and protein, actually. So those are all good things. The other thing Lynn added was asparagus. We'll have that added. And then the other thing I thought of as I was going through here in terms of, well, nutrients, we'll look at that in a minute, but is niacin, which is super important. So let's look at some of the nutrients that support cardiovascular health. And this, you know, the integrity of that cardiovascular system is going to be supportive of keeping the blood pressure under control. So CoQ10, super important. And that's why I talked about not overdoing it on the red yeast rice. Be careful with that. And oh, of course, statins, because they do deplete CoQ10. And CoQ10 is super important for energy metabolism. And I don't mean just energy like, I have a lot of energy, but energy on a cellular level. Like every single organ and gland needs to be cellularly activated so that they can do their job, eliminate waste, bring in nutrients, and do their function. And CoQ10 is super important there and for the Krebs cycle. So it helps to support the strength of the heart and the strength of the cardiovasculature and the energy there. EPA and DHA, we mentioned those already. Icosapentaenoic acid and docosahexaenoic acid. And those are omega-3s. They're not the essential fatty acids. The essential fatty acids are gamma-linolenic and linoleic acid, but they're super important in oftentimes needed in high doses when there's already disease there. There's a very big difference between preventative and curative or treating. And when we're working at getting rid of a certain pathology or condition, we may be taking higher doses of specific isolated nutrients to get it under control and then move to the foods for the maintenance. GLA, gamma linoleic acid, it's in hemp seeds, it's in borage oil, or borage, evening primrose, and blackcurrant. And we oftentimes get an imbalance of these, and a very good test to run with anybody with problems with hypertension or cardiovascular health, I would recommend running a blood spot fatty acid test. The minerals, we already talked about magnesium, but zinc is super important here. And zinc is one of the nutrients that's oftentimes extremely low because it's so hard to absorb. It's needed to make stomach acid, and stomach acid is needed to absorb the zinc. So when we're looking at zinc and zinc deficiencies and potential, I'm looking at a liquid zinc, and liquid zinc being like an ionized form. Several companies make them. I know Thorne makes it, and Premier Research Labs, and Trace Minerals Research, which I wouldn't recommend that one because it's very concentrated and a lot of people get nauseous with it. So maybe fine for you, but I'd try some of the others. And Good State has it too. Arginine. Arginine's precursor to the nitric oxide, but you do have to be careful of arginine because if you have a tendencies to herpes, then it could cause a herpes outbreak if you take too much. Carnitine helps to shuttle the fats into the cells from the bloodstream, so it decreases the fat buildup in the bloodstream, and that's going to help to make the blood flow. The blood needs to be a certain viscosity. If it's too thick, it can cause hypertension and potential for heart disease. If it's too thin, you might bleed really easily. So it's a balance here. N-acetylcysteine, which is a precursor to glutathione, and that supports and protects these cells on a very deep level. It's an important antioxidant. And then lipoic acid, which is an important antioxidant as well. So those are some of the things. Does it mean I want you to go out and buy every single one of these and try it? No, work through it. Get the lifestyle stuff down pat and then start introducing the nutrients. There are some tests you can do, certainly, to find out if you're deficient in these, the NutriEval, but it's a $600 or $700 test. The SpectraCell, which I thought was $600, but somebody told me they lowered the price. I haven't investigated that. We need to look at the nutrition and lifestyle approaches to balance the entire cardiovascular system in terms of getting the blood pressure under control. So if you smoke, you gotta quit because it's causing constant damage on your blood vessels. Weight loss, getting to your ideal weight is so, so important. That extra weight puts so much more stress. I just read a statistic recently that it's a 500% increase in the risk of heart disease and just out of the blue, sudden heart attack when you've got elevated blood sugar and or you're overweight. This is huge. It's huge. And exercise, of course, whatever is in your capacity. If you have knees that don't work, you know, and it hurts to exercise when you're running, find something else. Find swimming. Find exercises that use your upper body. Find things that work. And we, you know, we can certainly point you in the direction of some amazing people in our community that can help you create an exercise plan that's right for you. Maria Horseman, look her up on Facebook. She has a great Facebook group and she's very good at getting together with people on a one-on-one basis and or even in a group, small group, online so you don't have to travel to help you to optimize that. Stress management, we went through that, super important, the grounding. And a whole foods, plant-based diet that's high in greens, fruits, and vegetables. If you are eating animal products, they should be a small percentage and they should be organically raised and pastured. I take a lot of exception to the current rage in paleo and keto, and I'll tell you why. I personally follow a ketogenic diet, and mostly the time I'm in ketosis, but I do it with a whole foods plant-based diet, and I only eat whole food fats. When you start to eat fats in the form of oils, those are oxidized and those cause damage to your blood vessel lining. So I eat whole food fats. Of course, you know, my husband will make a stir fry sometimes using extra virgin olive oil or avocado oil, and I'll eat it. I can't be 100% when I travel, but for the most part, I don't eat oils. I eat whole food plant-based fats and plenty of them. And this craze towards drinking oil all day and eating a lot of animal products in order to stay in ketosis, it's dangerous. Short term, yeah, lose weight, great. Ketones go up, great. But the long-term effects of that have not yet been seen because it's not meant to be a long-term diet. But it can be very devastating because you're not getting the fiber, you're not getting the antioxidants, you're not getting all the things that you need. So really be careful in evaluating all the diets out there. Paleo, same. I love the paleo concept of eating like our ancestors did, but our ancestors didn't have access to making coconut flour pancakes. I mean, that wasn't on their agenda, right? That was not there. They also didn't have access to animals to eat all day long, three times a day. They had access to animals every couple of weeks, and then they might eat every three times a day for 3 days until it was gone. But then they went back to mostly foraging. And if we truly want to do a Paleolithic type diet, we want to be high in the foods that our Paleolithic ancestors had access to, which was greens that grow above the ground, fruits that grew in the trees, nuts and seeds, and roots that they dug up. And they didn't cook them. I don't, you know, they didn't have fire back in those days. So the kind of paleo diet that's out there is not really paleo because they're cooking and they're frying and they're baking and they're doing all this other stuff. I'm not saying those things are bad. I'm just saying it's just a misnomer. And you can use the concepts there, which is to avoid sugars and flour and breads and things like that, but don't do it to the extreme of excluding so many of the great vegetables and fruits. High antioxidant diet, and that comes from eating whole foods, plant-based, especially if you're including lots of the green leafy vegetables. Sleep is so important, and I know it's my downfall, and I try to get away with not sleeping on a regular basis, but unfortunately it's important, and we got to get people sleeping. And if people have trouble sleeping, this is our module that we're working on in our Body Freedoms this month, and all the NEPT, ERC, and Body Freedom people have access to that. It's just challenging when you don't sleep because you don't repair, you don't detox, you don't burn fat. People get stuck at certain weights when they can't sleep. Omega-3 fats, we mentioned that before, but it's worth mentioning EPA, DHA, and GLA. The short terms, the ones that are actually required that the body can't make are the ones that come from like flax seeds and chia seeds and hemp seeds and walnuts and some of our nuts and seeds, and then maintaining sugar balance. So I'm not into a this for that approach, guys. I'm not into like, here's your hypertension approach, here's the herbs, take these and you'll be fine. No, it's really about balance, and this is what we're all working towards. And then specifically, blood clots can cause hypertension. If there's clotting there, the pressure has to be elevated to actually push the blood through. And so what we want to do is look at some of those herbs. And if you're in this situation, then I highly recommend that you work with somebody to help you create the right balance of these herbs for you. Proteolytic enzymes, we talked about, natokinase, magnesium, safflower, North Indian catmint, ginkgo biloba, ginger, garlic, cayenne, cat's claw, dandelion, and horsetail. These are all very supportive, some of them in different ways, you know, providing specific minerals like horsetail and dandelion supporting the liver and diuresis, so we eliminate the excess fluid in the bodies. And some of them are anti-inflammatory. And you see some of these over and over again on the charts. That's a clue, right? Start with the simple ones like the ginger and garlic and cayenne that you can actually put in your foods, and from the previous ones, the basil and the oregano and all. And then work from there. Finally, let's talk about hypotension. Not as common, definitely not as common, but it's there. And a lot of people have what's called orthostatic or postural hypotension. And what that means is that the blood pressure when you lay down to when you stand up doesn't go up. So for example, if you're sitting and you get your blood pressure taken, which is the typical in the doctor's office, and your blood pressure is, let's just say it's 110 over 80 or 110 over 75. That's a nice one. And then you lay down. You would expect that blood pressure goes down, right? So maybe you lay down and you get your blood pressure taken and it goes down to say, let's say 100 over 65. Then you stand up. And within a minute of standing up, that blood pressure should go back up. And it should go up at least 10 points. So if it goes down to 100 over 65, it should go up to 110 over 75. If that doesn't happen, or when you get up, you experience dizziness and lightheadedness, that's an indication of hypotension, postural hypotension, or orthostatic hypotension. And that is oftentimes an issue with adrenal distress. Person who's in adrenal burnout, they can't get the sympathetic response. They're very tired and low energy. And that changes, and that's a great way to monitor for improvement if you're working on your adrenals, is to just see how that gets better over time, and it does. So that's orthostatic hypotension. And there's some symptoms associated with that in terms of lightheadedness and dizziness. Bend down to tie your shoes and get up, and you go, whoa, the room is spinning. And I periodically have that happen, and I know it usually happens when it's times of stress and times of not sleeping enough where my adrenals are getting a little burned out. Then there's general hypotension, like somebody who all the time has that. And that could be a pathology, that could be a problem. But if they don't have symptoms associated with it, it may not be a problem, right? As long as they have good energy and you're not dizzy and lightheaded and feeling good, then, you know, there's a range. So, you know, generally, doctors don't like to see it go below 90 over 60. But if it does and the person's feeling great, great. But it can also be indicative of an underlying pathology, internal bleeding, some kind of stress inside the body. So if your blood pressure suddenly becomes lower, get it checked out, because it may be some kind of internal damage that's going on that you want to be aware of. But if you have the postural hypotension, really look at the adrenals. So some of the symptoms might be fainting. You know, somebody periodically just faints, or faints after getting up quickly. Dizziness, well, whoa, the room is spinning. I just tied my shoe and the room is spinning, or just got up out of bed and the room is spinning. A feeling of lightheadedness, like, I'm not quite right there, right? Chest pain. You can actually get chest pain because your heart's trying to get some blood up to your head and it's not able to, because there's not enough pressure. A blurred vision, right? You're not getting enough blood into the brain and the eyes, and increased thirst. So body's like, oh, I need more fluid. And sometimes it is from dehydration. If it's not postural, it can be from dehydration. So you really have to watch that. And it can be nausea. So these are some of the signs of hypotension. And what we do is we look, what's the underlying cause? If it's persistent hypotension, it's under 90 over 60, I'd get checked out. I'd get a thorough exam to find out if there's any problems, if there's any internal bleeding. Get a blood test to see if there's any markers off, like low iron, stuff like that. And if you just tend to be tired and wired and under a lot of stress, it could be your adrenals, and that's more of a postural hypotension, and you'll notice it. Just try it. Get a blood pressure cuff. They're inexpensive. I highly recommend that everybody has one. When we did our Genes, Your Diet, and Your Health live stream in the summer, we gave a list. And I believe you probably can still get access to that. I would have Lynn put up a link to that. I think you can still get the recordings of that, because it was an amazing 2 days. And I shared so much great information that it's certainly worth having. You want to look at getting your own blood pressure cuff if you have tendency towards this lightheadedness, dizziness, or hypotension, or hypertension, because it's great. You can get a wrist cuff, or you can get an arm cuff, and you can do automatic, right? You don't have to be like trained and skilled like a doctor. Those are not 100% accurate. If you get a wacky reading, do it again. It may be just off. You have the cuff positioned wrong, but it gives you a general idea of where you're at and how well things are going. This concludes my presentation on blood pressure. I hope that this was helpful.